Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome to this program someone who I'm sure folks around Champaign-Urbana will know, but who has never been here on the program before. And our guest this morning for the first hour is Dave Leake. He is director of the Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College. He also teaches physics and astronomy there. He does the Friday night shows there at the planetarium and was good enough to come over here and talk with us a little bit about what you can see in the sky this time of the year. And this is something that we do periodically throughout the year, but because, of course, the sky changes, there's always something a little bit different. And we have these shows so we can talk a little bit about that and also give people the opportunity who are listening to ask questions about astronomy. And I know that Dave would do his best to answer those questions. Perhaps we'll get a chance here to talk a little bit about some of the things that will be going on at the planetarium. So certainly if you live in Champaign-Urbana and you haven't been there for one of the shows, shame on you. You should head out there and see it because it's a lot of fun. And, of course, if you have kids, it's an ideal sort of activity for families to do together. So we can talk a little bit about that. Whatever seems to be on your mind, astronomically speaking, you can give us a call. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, usually when we do these shows, we just at the beginning, I ask whoever it is that's here just to say a couple of things about the highlights of the sky at this particular time. So you would say to people, now I want you to look up and I want you to look here and this is what you're going to see. Is there something that's really a standout feature right at the moment?
I think the first thing that people will notice if they go out underneath the skies over central Illinois are the two bright lights over in the western part of the sky. One of them's hanging very low, just a little north of west, and that's the planet Venus, the brightest planet in the solar system. In fact, I have a friend who runs the control tower out at Willard and says that there actually are some pilots that will call in and say, let the other person land, thinking that Venus are some landing lights, because that's what it looks like. It's not very high. The thing that's a little not quite as bright, but in the southwest, is the planet Jupiter. Now, the thing that's interesting is the name planet means wanderer, so the planets will appear to move as they orbit the sun. And Venus and Jupiter are going to be getting close together at the end of August. So what's interesting is to watch them now and see how far apart they are now, and then keep an eye on them throughout the entire month, and you'll actually see why we call them wanderers.
Right. And for those, this is one of those things that we've talked about I'm with other astronomy guests on the show. To how it is that you tell when you're looking up there and you're seeing these objects, and they're all points of light, different sizes, different intensities. Sometimes you can actually detect a color difference, although it's probably kind of hard to do with the naked eye. How you tell the difference between a star and a planet?
Great question. And really, there's two reasons. One of them takes a little time, and that is, of course, the planets will appear to move. They will shift their position against the background stars. The other thing is that since the planets are they're closer to us, so through a telescope they appear a little larger, not just a pinpoint, that they won't appear to twinkle. The twinkling comes from an atmospheric effect of the pinpoint of light coming through the many layers of turbulent atmosphere to our eyes. And the planets, being a thicker beam of light coming at us, isn't affected as much by the twinkling. So basically, if you see a point of light in the sky that's twinkling, you found a star. And if it's a very steady light, you found a planet. If it has a red flashing light on it, then I'm assuming that's an airplane.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, we have a caller here, and we'll go right to them rather than make them wait. Someone listening this morning in Indiana. On our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. A couple of questions about the 10th planet. First one is the pronunciation of K-U-I-P-E-R. I've heard it two different ways on the radio, and worrying about that. And secondly, the discovery of the 10th planet, were they using any more recent astronomical devices, or was it sort of the standard telescopes that, you know, have been around for quite some time? Third question is, there seems to be some discussion in the astronomical community whether it's a planet at all, and that would lead to the question, which side are, well, maybe you are on, but which side are, you know, the heavies on, and which side are the controversial boys on, or whatever. Anything you could give about that would be greatly appreciated. Thanks a lot.
All right. Sure, thank you. Another great question. And I was just telling David, we've been talking all morning about Ed Kieser's wedding, and I was actually in Ed Kieser's wedding, so I was a witness to that. And at the reception, somebody asked me, what about that 10th planet? And being in Youngstown, Ohio, I knew nothing about it. So so I came back and kind of crammed for that one. So I appreciate you asking. First off, the name is Kuiper. Kuiper was an astronomer who postulated that this belt of comets, we were observing comets and their orbits, and they seem to be coming from this belt that is out beyond the planet Pluto. At the time, had no evidence for it, but now we're finding these Kuiper belt objects, as they're called. In fact, we found over 600 of them as of today. Most of them are small, little snowballs out there. Second, as far as the planet goes, again, very interesting situation, because I had somebody from a newspaper called me a while back and said, what about this? What, is this a planet or not? Wanted a yes or no answer. I can't give you that. What is really interesting to me is that this isn't your mother and father's solar system. We all knew there were 9 planets, and we knew what an asteroid was. We knew what a comet was. Now the definitions are getting fuzzy. And I see that as a very good thing. Science does change. And so if you're going to try to pin me down, I can't tell you. The object, there's actually 2 of them. And if you're keeping score, one is 2003 UB313. Put that on a license plate. And the other one is 2003 EL61. And one is smaller than Pluto. UB313 actually, they think now, is about 1.5 times the size of Pluto. And we really don't have a definition of what a planet is. We know what a star is. If there are nuclear reactions going on in the core of a star, then we can call it a star. So we're not really sure about these things. I can tell you, ask about instrumentation. Probably the best thing we have pointing at this thing is the Spitzer Space Telescope, which sees things in infrared light. If your house is emitting heat and you're trying to plug that up, you take an infrared picture of it. So anything that's giving off even minute amounts of heat, we can see with the Spitzer. And we can set a mass limit with that. And because really the size of these things are really just how much light they reflect. So we're taking a few guesses there, but it's a very, very exciting thing. I can tell you this, that UB313 is about 97 times as far from the sun as the Earth is. And Pluto on the average is about 40. So we're looking at about twice as far away, roughly, as Pluto is.
Mm-hmm. And this was, as my understanding was, this was discovered using a ground-based instrument.
That's right, yeah. In fact, out at the old, Palomar Observatory out in California, mm-hmm. and they found this. And most of the planets kind of inhabit this belt in the sky. We call it the ecliptic plane. The solar system is basically, relatively flat, like a pizza pan. And this one was well above, about 44 degrees above this plane, which is why we hadn't found it till now. When the person that discovered Pluto was looking, he didn't look that far out of the plane of the solar system.
Well, it seems to me this is not the first time that someone has proposed that there is a 10th planet. And I guess my understanding was that, though a lot of astronomers say, there is this belt of material, the Kuiper belt. There's all kinds of stuff out there, and apparently the objects there are pretty big. That sort of gets to this whole question of how big does it have to be for it to be a planet. But apparently, there's all kinds of big stuff out there. So if you wanted to set some sort of size limit, you might indeed end up with a number of objects that, if you felt like it, you could say, those are planets too, and we'll give them names and say, yes, indeed, the solar system has, instead of 9, it has 12 or 13 or 15 or who knows.
Somebody, I don't remember the number, but somebody this weekend proposed a size limit. And if that sticks and it's just somebody making up a number, then the largest asteroid, which is Ceres, it's about the size of Texas, would in fact be considered a planet. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, planet, asteroid, I mean, they're names. It's interesting just that these things are out there. And I know human beings like to put things in bins and give them names. And, the name planet is just that. It's just a name.
Mm-hmm. So, but at minimum, it is an object of certain size that orbits a star?
Yes. Yes. And I say that would be a good definition. But there really isn't a definite definition for that, like not on the books, not actually written out. Mm-hmm. So.
And you did say that there was in New York, the there at their there's a planetarium and
yes, the Rose Center there, yeah.
In New York. They've actually dropped Pluto off the list.
It was thought that Pluto itself is probably like these objects that we're finding, and so maybe Pluto is not a quote planet unquote, but the largest Kuiper Belt object. And the reason it's still a planet is thanks to millions and millions of school children who said, "You're not taking Pluto away from us." That Pluto, black holes, and aliens are the three big questions I usually get. Where's Pluto at? So, and right now, every planetarium that I know about recognizes Pluto as a planet, except the Rose Center in New York. They have dropped it from their solar system.
Our guest this morning is Dave Leek. He's director of the Starkol Planetarium at Parkland College, and he also teaches physics and astronomy out there. We're talking a little bit about astronomy, what you can see in the sky this time of year. And if you have questions, and we have a few here, I know he'll do his best. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller here is in Whiteheath and line one.
Hi, I'm calling because my husband built a telescope, and he just likes to build things, but we just really don't know anything about astronomy. So we're having difficulty really seeing something through this telescope. You know, we can see things on the ground, but I guess I don't know what it depends upon, but I'm wondering if there's any books out there for a novice astronomer that we could pick up that might give us some direction.
Well, I've never built my own telescope before, but there are a couple of, I don't have the patience, but there are some good books. A very old one I have is Sam Brown's All About Telescopes, which is
Sam Brown.
Yeah, okay. It's got a lot of illustrations in it. One of the things I might mention to you is there are several astronomy clubs around. I know here in Champaign-Urbana, we have the CU Astronomical Society that meets every second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. at the planetarium at Parkland. I don't think anybody in our group actually does astronomy for a living. And we do have, not me, but we do have several very, very good telescope makers in the group. Ah. And I'm sure that they could help you out. In fact, our observatory is between Champaign and Sedaris. And if you wanted to bring the telescope, if it's portable.
Well, you could, it's sort of big.
Okay. I'm sure we could get somebody to help you out because they're very community-oriented group of people.
All right, and say that again, the second Tuesday?
Second Thursday.
Thursday.
Of the month.
Mm-hmm. Of the month. At what time again?
At 7 p.m. at the planetarium.
Okay.
And you don't have to be a member to show up.
All right, great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So anybody who is interested in astronomy and would like to get together with other people who have similar interests should feel welcome to stop by.
Oh, sure, definitely.
Yeah. And also, I'm sure that now once school gets going here on the U of I campus, they also have an open house at the old observatory that's on the campus.
That's right.
They do that once a month?
First Friday of the month at the CU Astronomical Society Observatory, and that's the one I just referred to between here and Sedaris. We base our open houses by the moon phase, the Saturday closest to the first quarter moon. So if you have a calendar that has moon phases on it. The University of Illinois Observatory, which is at the south end of the quad, that's the first Friday of the month.
All right. Very good. So there are opportunities. And if you don't have your own telescope and you just like to look through one and perhaps also get some tips from somebody who does actually kind of already know where to look and how to point it and some things about that, then for both of those cases, and certainly at the observatory on the U of I campus, you can get a chance to look through a fairly good-sized telescope, a real classic sort of telescope.
Oh, yes. I think it was built in 1896, but it still works wonderfully. And I don't mean for this to be a shameless plug, but I'm also doing at the end of September, I should say, it's called Backyard Astronomy. It's a 5 weeks workshop just for novices of how to find things in the sky and to check the Parkland College Live and Learn brochure, which will come out, actually might be out this week. And there'll be information about that workshop in there.
Great. Okay. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's
go
to Belgium over by Danville. That would be line two. Hello.
Good morning, all.
Mm-hmm.
Couple quick questions I hope you can answer. I'm sure you can answer. There's no question about that. Took my annual trip to the West here recently, and I watched Mercury for a while.
I believe so. Yeah, Mercury was there near Venus last month, but Mercury doesn't stay in one place for very long.
No, it seems to move awful fast.
Yeah, I believe in August it heads back into the morning sky.
Oh, that's unfortunate. I'm a night person. Oh, well, that's the way it goes. As I traveled, I went pretty far north this time, and I noticed, and it's a phenomenon we all know about, it stays lighter longer. Okay, and in the north it stays lighter so much longer than it does here, and but yet at the equator the times of the day doesn't vary very much, just very shortly, and it seems so puzzling. You know, I understand it's the tilt of the Earth, but it's so dramatic. It's so absolutely. You just go 600 miles farther north, and it stays light a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. And then you go to the North Pole, and it's light.
Yeah, it stays light all day long. But it seems kind of unintuitive why it does that. I mean, if you think about it, well, why would we get almost as much? But and why should it stay so constant at the equator?
One of the things we do at the planetarium we call them sun arcs. We can actually put the path of the sun up there for the solstices and the equinoxes. And, you know, I've been teaching astronomy a long time, but until you really see that, it really becomes clear. Because the sun, if you look, now, of course, this is, as you said, this is all because of the tilt of the Earth. The sun isn't really changing. But from our vantage point, there are really three parallel arcs. You have the summer solstice and then spring and fall equinoxes and winter solstice. And if you actually look at the path that the sun takes across the sky, it's really amazing. It's, you know, it's not up there very long in the winter, but it follows this big arc in the summer. And then when you change your latitude, of course, that kind of changes the position of these three kind of parallel arcs for the course of the year. And it is really interesting. You know, watch where – now, of course, we're a ways from the summer solstice now, but watch where the sun sets. When I went to Ed's wedding, I had to leave at 4:30 in the morning, and I couldn't believe the sun was rising where it was at. I mean, it's you know, when it starts getting light, it's pretty far to the north.
Yes, it is. It almost throws you off, doesn't it? Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Dave Leake. He is the director of the Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College. He also is associate professor of physics and astronomy. And we're talking about what you can see in the sky this time of year. And if you have questions, you can call us. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Bethany. That's line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hey, thank you for telling me how to pronounce Kuiper. I've wondered about that for a long time. I've also wondered about something else that's puzzled me. I've heard about the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt, and are they the same thing? Are they separate, or could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I don't have all the distances in front of me, but as far as numbers go, but let's say think of the solar system as a pizza pan. Again, it's not exactly flat like that, but it's kind of in a plane. And the Kuiper belt is also in the same plane beyond that. So you can almost think about it, if I can get away with using the word torus, so like a flat ring around the outside. Now, the Oort cloud is a big spherical cloud that's, you know, might be a third of the way to the next star. So we think that the solar system maybe started out somewhat spherical and then because of something called angular momentum kind of flattened out into this pancake. But we still have some of this the spherical cloud that's way, way out there. And the Kuiper belt's closer and it's in the same plane as the solar system.
Well, okay, that explains a lot then.
Jan Oort came up with that.
Who's that?
A man named Jan Oort, who is an astronomer over in, I believe, the Netherlands, if I'm not mistaken.
What year was that? Do you have any idea?
My goodness. Probably in the, guess the 50s. I'd have to check that to be sure. Okay. Wasn't just recently, though.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call. To Champaign next, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I have two separate questions. The first one is going back to the 10th planet issue. Could you describe a little bit about the size of the solar system? I've always kind of imagined the edge of our solar system being Pluto, and now you're saying that this 10th planet, which is supposed to be in our solar system, is twice the distance from the sun as Pluto is. And then the second question I have is regarding Mars. I've received an email saying that Mars is supposed to be closer to Earth than it has been in thousands or hundreds of thousands of years.
I was wondering when somebody was going to bring that up.
Thanks.
So bless you for doing that.
All right. Thank you very much for the call.
First, on the side of the solar system, let me do it this way without throwing a lot of numbers at you. Think of the sun as being a big beach ball. In fact, we have a model out at Parkland. It's about they're working on the road, so you can't get to it right now, but it's about 38 inches across. On that scale, the Earth is a marble about 110 yards away. If you can imagine that, a Pluto would be a grain of sand about 2.5 miles from that beach ball. Now, we haven't put, of course, these new objects in our solar system, but if you can imagine, it'd be something 1.5 times a grain of sand. So it's still not real significant. And of course, I guess if it's twice as far, that'd be roughly 5 miles away from our beach ball. So, and on that scale, the nearest star on that scale would be about twice as far away as twice the diameter of the real Earth.
Well, it's as far as what constitutes our solar system, then, though, is it the sun and all of the things that we consider planets, do we consider the Kuiper Belt to be part of the solar system?
We do consider the Kuiper Belt to be part of the solar system. One of the things that our Voyager probes are doing, which were launched back in 1977 and sent out of the solar system after taking a tour of the planets, is some of the instruments are still working, and we're trying to figure out where the sun's influence ends. And we're right about at that point right now. I haven't heard the latest word on that, but we're close to about that point. Now, about Mars, very quickly, there is something. I get about 3 emails a day and phone calls, so I'm really glad that you brought this up. Mars will not be as close. 60,000 years, I believe, in August of this year. However, in August 27th of 2003, it was that close. So not sure why the email is still going around again. As the Earth catches up with Mars, we're close to Mars every 26 months. So we're about to that point again. In fact, it'll be this late October, early November that we'll be close to Mars again. Not as close as it was in 2003. I'm not sure where this is coming from, but it's like an old email that's been dredged up. But some of you in local area might remember we had telescopes out at Meadowbrook Park in 2003, and we couldn't believe it. There was over 1,200 people there in this park, and so we got good looks at it. Also about Mars being, I believe it was bigger than a full moon. Well, whoever wrote that neglected to leave out, that's through a telescope. If you look at Mars through a telescope, apparently it will be about the size of a full moon. So, no, if Mars were just your eye the size of a full moon, we'd have other problems.
Yeah, I guess.
So
it'd be cool to look at.
Oh, well, yeah, we'd be able to see quite a bit on its surface and run for your life.
I do remember it really was beautiful at that point where it was the closest it's been in however long. It certainly was very, very beautiful. And at least to my eye, I guess different people see it differently, but to my eye, it was reddish.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see why it was that, it has this association with blood and war and fire, and why it's the red planet and why Mars is the god of war and all that sort of stuff.
And if you get up in the morning now, just before sunrise, when there's still some twilight, and I was driving Friday morning, so I saw this, Mars is a little more than halfway up. And just about due south, and it'll be almost the brightest thing there. And Mars is getting brighter because we are going to pass it again this late October, early November.
Okay, so it should be a good time again to – anytime probably be good, but particularly it'll be a good time to look for Mars.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's continue.
Sure.
So we'll talk next with some people here in Urbana. Line one first. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
David?
Yes.
This is Barbara Peckham with the Champaign County Museum.
Hi, Barb.
I just wanted to tell you how you are very much appreciated by the museums at the crossroads.
Oh, thank
eight
you.
Museums. you do such a beautiful job for us, and we just want you to know how you are appreciated.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you. And the museums at the Crossroads are an informal consortium of all 8 county museums. And we get together, our reps get together, and we talk about successes and problems and joint promotions. And it's a wonderful group of people, and Barb's a part of that.
And again, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay. Thanks for calling in.
Bye-bye.
Well, and I think people should definitely go and take advantage of the planetariums being here, certainly, because there is one in Chicago.
Yes.
I don't know where the next closest planetarium to us here in Champaign-Urbana would be.
Well, they have one in Kankakee and one at Illinois State, but we're the second largest in the state.
Okay. So definitely it's a great experience, a kind of thing to go out there and see. And as I said, if you're looking for something to do with your family, it's a great thing to do. It's even educational.
That's right. That's right. You can learn something.
That's kind of scary, but it's not always such a bad thing. Let's talk with someone here also in Urbana. This is line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Is caller there, line 2?
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, great, sorry. I saw a picture apparently taken by an astronaut aboard one of the missions, and it was a picture of the northern of the aurora from space, mm-hmm. and it looked off in the distance, and there, you know, closer to like the rounded ball of the Earth, you could see the northern lights. It looked like the different colors were at different altitudes. Mm-hmm. Was that a matter of perspective? Or are, in fact, the gases, that are responsible for different colors at various altitudes?
I do believe it's an altitude effect. Not only the gases, I don't know if Ed were here, he could answer this one, as far as the composition goes, how much that changes. But, the nitrogen glows one color, oxygen glows another color, and it's really just like a neon sign in a grocery store. It's just that. Instead of zapping it with 5,000 volts, here we're zapping these little atoms and molecules with particles from the sun. And so you're right. It is actually the air glowing. Different concentrations and probably different compositions.
Uh-huh. And the various gases are at different altitudes?
It's not. I don't want to suggest that like oxygen goes up so far and then the nitrogen takes over. It's not that, but probably the way they're mixed might be a little different. And I'll admit I'm kind of getting outside my area of expertise there. So,
okay. And then I had another question. You'll probably cover this about that Perseid meteor shower coming up.
Oh yeah, it's like I've planned it. All these people out there.
Good work.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you mentioned that too. Yeah, the Perseid meteor shower is probably, in my mind anyway, the next big event we have coming up. Throughout all of August, you can see shooting stars in the sky, but probably the night of August 11th and the morning of the 12th, and maybe even the next day too, is considered the maximum. And it's a wonderful thing to go out and see. It's like nature's fireworks, and you don't need equipment either. No telescope is necessary. Take a lawn chair out in the country. The darker it is, the better. You can stay in your backyard, but the darker, the better. And just look up, basically, and be patient. Hmm. The only downside about meteor showers is that the rates pick up after midnight. So we're going to go out maybe about 11 and see if we can stay out till sunrise and see how many we can count.
And the reason that the meteor showers have different names is that has to do with where most of them appear to be coming from.
So exactly.
Is there some particular point in the sky where you would expect to see more of them than any place else? It's not exactly a random kind of a thing.
Yeah, and not to be facetious, but up is the best direction. The constellation of Perseus will be rising in the northeast, but sometimes I hear people say face northeast. Well, if you're facing the horizon, you're going to miss a lot. Mm. The meteors will be all over the sky, but they will be, if you trace their paths backwards, they'll appear to come from the northeast. So really, it's just to look up. And they're not really coming from one spot, but the best example I can give is if you're standing in the middle of a railroad track, it looks like the tracks go together, like a vanishing point. Mm-hmm. And it's that same kind of effect. Actually, all the meteor particles coming in are roughly parallel.
But and the objects that are causing this light, how big a thing are we talking about?
About the size of a pencil eraser. But when they come through, they roughly 20,000, 30,000 miles an hour. And just the shock heating with the atmosphere. You see their trails. You don't actually see the little chunk that big, but you see the trail as it goes through the atmosphere.
And is this, do I remember this right, that this is stuff from, this is comet debris is what
yeah,
this is?
Yeah, it's a comet Swift Tuttle that comes around about every 120 years. And I think of comets as like Hansel and Gretel as they go through the forest and leaving breadcrumbs. But as comets go around the solar system, they leave dust. And if the Earth happens to run into that dust, then you see a meteor shower. And there's about roughly a dozen or so a year.
Okay. Well, we're a little bit past the midpoint here, and our guest on this first hour of Focus 580 is Dave Leake from Parkland College. He's director of the planetarium and teaches there, teaches physics and astronomy. And if you have questions about astronomy, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You want to take a minute and talk just a little bit about some of the things that will be happening at the planetarium this fall?
Sure, we can do that. We are just ending our summer schedule. We'll be going back to our regular schedule. We reduce it a little bit in the summer. And so in August, we'll be going back to our Friday and Saturday programs, which are 7, 8, and 9:30. The schedule is on our website, which if you just go to parkland.edu, it's linked to that. And our number is 351-2446. Which reminds me now that I'm back, I need to change that answering machine and update it for August. We have a program called Follow the Drinking Gourd about how African-American slaves during Civil War times used the stars to along the Underground Railroad. Summer Prairie Skies is always a big hit because it's our live sky show. And it's kind of rare anymore. I know Adler doesn't even do live shows, and we like to interact with the crowd on that. We also are doing a program called The Extraterrestrial Files, which is kind of a takeoff on the X-Files with, instead of, let's see, Scully and Mulder, we have Gully and Boulder. And they're taking a lighthearted look at life in outer space. But we are updating the show at the end with a little live segment to talk about these new planets that are we find around other stars, because there's a number of those. And then if you'd like, we can talk about the fall program sometime, too. We've got a number of things going on this fall.
Okay. And certainly if people have, as Dave says, if people have internet access, you can go to the Parkland College
sure.
website and you can find out what's going on there. Or all people can use the telephone and just call up the number and get the information there.
That's correct.
Very good. Well, let's go on. We'll get someone here next in Kankakee on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
Your caller was talking with a friend, we were aware that, of course, in the northern hemisphere, the sun rises and sets to the north at the summer solstice and to the south at the winter solstice. But at the same time, the moon rises and sets to the south at the summer solstice and to the north at the winter solstice, and we don't have a feel as to why this should be. What is it about the relationship between the orbits of the Earth and the Moon that causes this phenomenon?
Well, a couple of things. Probably the easiest thing to talk about is the full moon, since everybody has seen that. The full moon is always opposite the sun. So you think about if you draw a line from the sun, the Earth, to the moon, the Earth is in the middle. And then the moon being opposite from our vantage point, which means you mentioned the summer solstice. So the sun's coming up in the northeast. So that means that full moon is going to be setting at the same time, since it's got to be opposite, in the southwest. Okay, so if the think about it this way, if the sun is at the summer solstice, then the moon is going to be at the position, let's see if I can get this right, at where the sun would be during the winter solstice, because it would be opposite. And what complicates things is that the moon's orbit is off about 5 degrees. So it's not exactly opposite, or we would have eclipses once a month, both lunar and solar. Does that help any at all?
Yes. I was just trying to get a feel as to what that was, and that helped. Thank you.
Okay, right, thank
very
you.
Good, thank you. Let's go to Champaign, someone back here locally, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm calling with a philosophical question. I wondered if Dave, who is an expert in looking in the sky, if his faith has increased or decreased as a result of his work. Now, listen to your answers. Thank you.
Has what increased or decreased?
Yes.
I think she's talking about a religious faith.
Yes.
Oh!
Which is one of those things that, all, you know, sometimes people make this argument that somehow religion and science are incompatible with one another. And then, of course, there are scientists who come along and say, well, no, that's not true at all.
Yeah, it's difficult to give a short answer to that. I can tell you this, that if you go out where it's dark, away from town, and it's kind of a shame we have so many lights here in town, but if you go out where it's darker, and sometimes you can get telescopes out, look at this and that and the other thing, but just sometimes just to sit on the hood of your car and just to look up, and you just go, wow, it's just amazing. And to me, that's kind of a religious experience. Granted, if you get into the techie side of it, as you just mentioned, you know, there is this little conflict where the way I kind of simplified, and maybe it shouldn't be simplified, is in religion, they ask you to base things on faith. You know, you can say what you want, but it does have to get back to faith at some point. And science is kind of the opposite. Science doesn't want you to base anything on faith. You're supposed to base things on hard evidence. And that's kind of where the conflict lies. If your faith tells you one thing, I can't prove that wrong because that's what you feel. But science is a dog-eat-dog world, and if I come out and say, you know, I can flap my wings and fly, you know, somebody's going to say, show me. You got to have some evidence for that. And, you know, not to imply there's no evidence for religion, but eventually you do get back to a faith-based system. So, again, it's kind of two answers to that. That's kind of the science answer, but still, when you go out and look at the sky, it's a wonderful natural resource.
Yeah. And just to make the point, to reinforce the point you made, not a philosophical point, but that if people are lucky enough to be able to go someplace where the sky is really dark,
mm-hmm.
where there are not a lot of streetlights and other kinds of ambient light, it's can be really dramatic. And if you've never seen it, it's sort of stunning. So if you ever get the chance, it's really a great thing to see what the stars really look like and how many of them there are. And you can quite clearly see the Milky Way and a lot of other things.
Oh,
that
yeah.
If you happen to be in a city, even like Champaign-Urbana, you just can't see that because there's too much light around.
I don't have any dates in front of me right now, but keep on the lookout for times when our Astronomical Society does viewing from the meadow at Allerton Park, and that is just phenomenal. The skies out there are just fantastic.
Yeah, and I guess if you can get outside of Champaign-Urbana, you don't have to go too terribly far before you start to get rid of a lot of that light, and the viewing conditions do improve. I suppose it's not the same as if you were out someplace where it was really, if you were in the, you know, in the west someplace, or one of those places mm-hmm. where you're away from civilization and you're away from all that ambient light. That's going to be more dramatic. But even here in town, if you go the right direction, you don't have to get too far away, and you're going to start to get a much darker sky.
And it's a directional thing. With our observatory being between here and Sidoras, the northeast is basically wiped out by Champaign-Urbana, and we're, say, 20 minutes out, 20-minute drive out, and we don't even look towards the northeast because of the sky glow.
Yeah. Well, we have about 15 minutes left, and if folks who are listening have questions, you can call in here. Our guest is David Leake. He's director of the Starkwell Planetarium at Parkland College. He also teaches physics and astronomy there, and if you have questions, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And is there anything else that you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched on? I know there was a few things we said we didn't want to talk about, this Mars thing. We'll talk about this 10th planet thing. We got talked about the Perseids.
Yeah. One of the things, and this this is kind of plugging something at the planetarium, but there's a WILL connection, so I thought I would mention it, is I just finished booking our World of Science lecture series. On the first Friday of the month that classes are in session, we have a speaker come out at 7 p.m., and I try to make it so it's not just astronomy. And I know our own Ed Kieser is going to be out on December 2nd to talk about the Florida hurricanes. Who knows what it will be like, what kind of year we would have had in December, but also last year and why those are there. But we also have Stephen Hurst coming from the Department of Geology is going to talk about the Pedo Deep. an ocean trench that he's actually been in a submersible. He's going to bring some video of that. It should be fantastic. And Paul Quiet at the physics department is going to also come out and talk about Einstein. The Pedo Deep is October 2nd, and Einstein's Miracle Year is, of course, this is the 100th year for that, is November 4th. We have Jim Kaler coming out in February talking about our complex universe, a human understanding through art. We're going to have Sally Greenberg from the Geological Survey coming out in March to talk about radiocarbon dating. And our own Tony Burkhalter out at Parkland is going to be the April speaker talking about understanding the food you eat. And that one, you might want to eat before you go to that, because I have a feeling what she has going to have to say. I probably should change some of my habits.
All right. Very good. Well, and again, information available on the, you go to the Parkland website, and then from there you can get to.
That's right. And all the World of Science dates are on there. I updated that before I left.
Okay. Very good. Well, let's talk with some other folks here.
Sure.
Let's see. Champagne line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, sort of on your last questionnaire about faith and all that. On string theory, aren't we kind of taking that on faith? And my own theory, I have this real far out thing on string theory, is that basically maybe string theory explains God and all-knowing in all places and all times and all things. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, well, now, thank you. I will give you my view on that, but if there's somebody from the physics department listening, they maybe could call in and would have a more qualified opinion. String theory is kind of a neat idea. But to my knowledge, there is no observational evidence for string theory. It's something people are working on. It doesn't mean that there won't be. When Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, we didn't have a lot of evidence for that either. And then they came up with Mercury's orbit and light bending around the sun. And the theory of relativity has withstood every test since then. But there weren't a lot of tests initially. It was just a cool idea. If you think about Copernicus putting the sun at the center of the solar system, it was a cool idea. And right now, I'm simplifying it quite a bit, but I think string theory is a cool idea. And the evidence may come later, but I don't think, and again, somebody can call and correct me, but I don't think we have any observational evidence for it right now.
Can you give a very simple explanation of what it is for people who don't know, or maybe I know I've heard of it, but I may even have talked to somebody about it, but I'm not exactly sure I could tell you what.
Can I give a simple explanation? Yeah. No, I can't. But it's more or less, we have our electrons, our protons, our neutrons, but if you really reduce those, then you find out they're made of quarks, and we do have observational evidence for that. Mm-hmm. But then if you get down further, then the idea is that all these things are made up of a series of vibrating strings. Not so much you'd fly a kite with, but it's like energy. And but in order for string theory to work, and again, I'm pulling this out of memory, you have to have something like 11 dimensions, which is kind of beyond the layperson's understanding. But again, I'm not saying it's not true, but it's, in science, it's dog eat dog. And right now people are working on this, but I don't believe there's any direct observational evidence for it.
All right. Line three is next. Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I know we just discovered a planet that was about seven times the size of Earth, and that's the smallest planet that we've discovered thus far. What do you think the probability in our lifetime we might actually be able to detect either some signature of life such as oxygen on a planet, or perhaps liquid water? I know there's a telescope going up in, I think, like 2010 or something like that, or 2012. What do you think the probability we can actually detect even, the signature of life relatively soon?
I actually think it's quite good. A planet will reflect a light from a star, and that's the light we detect, run it through a spectroscope, and we can actually detect elements that way. Do want to clarify one thing, and you probably were thinking this already, but just to make sure it's clear for the listeners, the planet seven times the size of the Earth, that's not in our solar system. We are finding planets around other stars. And the way we do that, and I do a demonstration in my class of this, I pick up my son, who's 12. This is getting harder and harder to do now. When he was younger, it was easier. And I swing him around. Well, if I swing him around, I'm much bigger than he is, and so he goes flying around. But I also wobble. I don't stay in one place. Well, as planets go around stars, it makes them wobble just a little bit. But our instruments are good enough now to detect that, and we can get an idea of the mass or the size of some of these things. So we are finding, in fact, I'm sure this is low, but at one time there were 70 other star systems out there that had planets going around them. And of course, the big planets make the stars wobble the most. So those are the easiest to find, you know, something 20 times or maybe, you know, 15 times the size of Jupiter. But now our instruments are getting good enough, we're finding some of these smaller ones.
Yeah, and that's detecting the wobble in the star. I mean, our instruments are going to have to be, I know we can run spectrums of the lights and identify which elements are present, which compounds are present. But, I mean, like the Earth from, say, 75 light years away, I mean, yeah, you might be able, well, the amount of light reflected from Earth 75 light years away would be very, very small.
Yeah, and you're right. You're exactly right. And that's where you need very, very sophisticated instruments. And hopefully this next generation telescope, the Webb Space Telescope, which will eventually replace the Hubble, will be able to do something like that. You can maybe subtract out the light of the parent star and see what's left over and be able to find something like that.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Hey, right,
thanks
for calling.
Thanks for the call. Then you touch on something that I know we've talked about here on this program, and that is the end of the life of Hubble. And there was, I guess, within the astronomy community, a lot of discussion about could it be kept going a little bit longer? And I think the answer was, well, yes. I mean, it could be. If you decided that you wanted to spend the money, mm-hmm. you could send the shuttle up there and that it could do some maintenance and it could keep it going for some time longer, extend its usable life. And of course, that would cost money. And then there was the point when the shuttle was grounded, so there was
yes.
it wasn't even up for discussion. Now they're all backed up, and who knows now what's going to happen in the future with the shuttle. So maybe that answers the question. But where does that stand with this idea of doing a repair maintenance mission for the Hubble to then keep it going for a little while longer?
Well, of course, that got set back with they found that some of the foam fell off when the Discovery was launched, and now all the shuttles are grounded again.
Yeah.
And that's disappointing, but obviously we want to be safe. Anytime you do any missions like this, of course, it's very risky, but you get out of bed in the morning. Sometimes it's risky. The shuttle's gyros are going, and that'll make it very difficult to point if
the Hubble.
The
telescope.
Yeah, the Hubble telescope.
Right, right, right.
And the Webb telescope is there. It's, I believe it's ready to go. It's just, I do believe it was something like 2010 or something like that, that it was going to be, we were going to get it up there. So.
And was that also going to be taken up by a shuttle?
I believe, yes. I believe it was. But it was going to be put in just into orbit because they're going to put it. It's not going to actually orbit the Earth. They're going to put it out at what's called a Lagrangian point. So we don't have to worry about the Earth getting in the way of something that we want to see.
See, we do at least one more.
Sure.
Line number two, line Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wondered, the astronomy people have a unique situation. I wonder if they could do something like zone for light to go down rather than to go up. Is there any move afoot amongst astronomers to suggest to cities like Champaign that they zone so that lights go down instead of up?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because our CU Astronomical Society are taking a look at the lighting ordinances now. The mission, as stated in the Champagne lighting ordinance, is excellent as far as what they want to do. But a lot of the lighting codes cover street lights and parking lot lights. But I know people have called the planetarium and said, my neighbor's light shining in my window. I can't even, you know, it's daylight inside my bedroom at night, and there's nothing to cover that right now. And obviously, you never want to squelch any people's freedoms, but when your freedom intrudes on someone else, then maybe someone should look at that. So, yeah, we're hoping to kind of take a look at that. And not to get rid of lights. You don't want to do that. but they're called street lights, so let's light up the street.
Well, and I think, and I appreciate the caller's comment, I think that there are a lot of people who also argue that a lot of that we're wasting light and mm-hmm. therefore we're wasting energy. If indeed, as you say, the point is to light the street, if the light goes up, that we have wasted that energy because it's putting the light where we don't really need it.
Exactly.
So not only would it be more energy efficient, it would put the light where we want it. And then, of course, for people who are interested in looking up, it would also perhaps mm-hmm. help to dampen down on the light pollution problem.
The example I give is you'd never take your water sprinkler and put it out on the boulevard and water the street. No one would think of that. It's a waste of water. But we do it with our light all the time.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, again, with the suggestion that if you're interested in finding out what's going on out at Parkland, and if you've never been to the planetarium, think about going out there, go to the Parkland web page. And you can get the schedule, or you can call them and find out what's going on there.
Yep, 351-2446 is the number out there.
Our guest, Dave Leek, is the director of the Starkel Planetarium. He teaches physics and astronomy at Parkland College. Thanks.
Thanks so much, David.